Welcome to the Fifth Estate, the Wheel Ascenders' new fortnightly podcast. Recorded in front of an audience in our performance space here in Melbourne, we present news without the cycle, analysis without the spin, aiming for a more measured approach to the big stories of the moment. Your host for the Fifth Estate's indispensable live journalism is broadcaster, journalist and anthropologist Sally Warhaft.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the first Fifth Estate for 2013. I'm Sally Warhaft. And while the Fourth Estate can whip themselves up into a lather of hysteria about Kevin and the polls, here at the Fifth Estate, we're going to have a serious look at what lies ahead in the real world. And it's a great, great pleasure to be kicking off our series this year with a very special panel, a trio of perhaps the finest thinkers on foreign policy, certainly in Australia, if not the world. And it is our special Fifth Estate and Lowy Institute special. So joining us is Dr. Michael Fullilove, and he's the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. He is a Rhodes Scholar who has worked as a visiting fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He's been an advisor to Paul Keating. He's the author of a very fine book of Australian speeches, and his forthcoming book, and Michael, I promise I am not going to write one on the same subject this time, is Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America to War. That's coming out in May with Penguin Books. Linda Jacobson is the East Asia Program Director at Lowy. She lived in China for 20 years. She speaks Mandarin and has published 6 books about China and East Asian society. Linda was a Harvard Fellow and worked previously for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute and the Finnish Institute of International Affairs. And Rory Metcalf is the Director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. He has worked with the Office of National Assessments in Canberra as a diplomat in New Delhi. He's been on secondment to Japan's foreign ministry, and he worked as a truce monitor in Bougainville. He is the Senior Research Fellow in India Strategic Affairs at the University of New South Wales, a fellow at the Australia-India Institute, and he convenes the Australia-India Roundtable. He is a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution because not even Rory can be in two places at once. Please welcome our 3 Lowy Luminaries. I want to start with a broad brush, and from an Australian perspective, there's this churning tension between an optimistic view that global economic self-interest and the desire to develop and consume will keep Australia safe and rich, and a much darker pessimistic view that there are a lot of nation states in our corner of the world with very nasty weapons and desires and all competing for power. A lot of hostility and muscle and mystery, really. How is this tension dealt with, and how should it be dealt with in our foreign policy? I might start with you, Michael.
Well, thank you, Sally. First of all, can I say it's a real delight for us as representatives of the Institute to be here at the Wheeler Centre and to be back in Melbourne. And we hope that we can do more events like this with Wheeler, and because we know there's a big appetite for foreign policy here. Secondly, thank you for the somewhat extravagant introduction.
No, it was. I had to edit it till it hurt. Let me tell you.
I was reminded actually when you were going through all those lists of something that was once said of Dr. Kissinger, which is that no one needs an introduction less than him, and no one enjoys it more. But thank you very much for that. In terms of your question, I was thinking on the way that, as you mentioned, when I was a young man, I worked for Mr. Keating when he was Prime Minister. And in those days, the Australian Prime Minister travelling overseas to CHOGM, which is a very ungainly acronym, the Commonwealth Heads of Government Meeting, that was actually sort of a big deal in the sense that the Australian Prime Minister got to be in a summit meeting with the head of government in Britain and some other significant countries. And since then, the pace of our interactions with the world has gone through the roof. And so now Prime Ministers are constantly jagging around the world, you know, to APEC and APEC leaders meeting and the East Asia Summit and ASEM. And now we are a member of the two most important global forums, the G20 on the economic side and the economic and financial side, and now from the 1st of January, the UN Security Council. And so now we are really, it's not hyperbole to say, we are at the big tables. And I guess my question, and it's unresolved in this at the beginning of this, the longest election campaign in the history of the world, is whether our political system has adjusted to that and whether our leaders have adjusted to it and whether our officials have adjusted to it. And I fear that they haven't. I fear that we, for a long time, our political class and our leaders have got into the habit of being able to let a lot of big issues go through the keeper because we don't have to worry about that too much. We need to worry about our patch. But now the world is intruding on us and on our interests and on our future. And whether it's the upside of the Asian century, as the Prime Minister detailed when she launched her white paper at the Lowy Institute actually in October last year, whether it's the downside, the dark side you mentioned of tensions between China and Japan, whether it's Syria, which in the past we could say, well, Syria, what does that have to do with us? That's the domain of the Security Council. Well, now we're on the Security Council, so it's our problem. We're either a part of the problem or we're a part of the solution. But whether our leaders and us as a people have fully grappled with that and fully internalised it and made these things the stuff of debate is not clear to me. I don't think we have, and I fear we're going into a year where we're going to see more of the same and less of grappling with these great historic gigantic challenges and opportunities.
Was it evident when you did, say, work with Keating? Is this something that's become foggier to you, or has it always been unclear?
One thing that strikes me is that when I was in Keating's office and I was working on the speeches side of things rather than the foreign policy side of the shop, I do remember, and I was struck by it the other day, how big an issue Indonesia was in the public mind. I mean, you might remember Keating made this a huge thing. I mean, he educated Australians about the economy. He wanted to educate us about Indonesia. He made an enormous deal about it. He invested an enormous amount in it. You barely hear the name. You barely hear about Indonesia now. We talk a lot about China, and that's absolutely right. I'm glad we do, Linda, by the way, as Australia's leading China watcher. But it does seem to me that we've taken our eye off the ball at exactly the time that events and history are conspiring us to push us into the game. And we've sort of retreated, and we're now much more comfortable playing in our comfort zone.
Linda.
Well, listening to Michael and you, Sally, I'm going to approach this dismal prospects that Asia has for us from a bit of a different perspective. I came to Australia just under 2 years ago, and what you read in the media is a lot about the dismal, about the looming possible crisis between many countries actually in Asia, and on the other hand, how important economically China, India are to Australia. But I've been going back every second or third month since moving here. And the thing that's missing, I think, in Australian discussion about what's going on in Asia is that dynamism, that excited wanting to go forward, wanting to make a better life. So there's an optimism there that is very contagious when you're there. And I think it doesn't really come through here. We look at it either from Australia's point of view as what can we benefit from, or is it all going to stop because there's going to be a war, or is there going to be a terrible crisis? But there's a lot of optimism, there's a lot of good feeling and vibrant energy, especially in China, I know in India as well, but across Southeast Asia at the moment.
Yeah, look, I'd build on what Linda and Michael have said in that there's, I'm sure I'll disagree with them in due course, Sally, but at the moment, I'd say that there's there's a huge tension between the kind of optimism Linda's talking about. I mean, if you look at, for example, the youth of India, if you look at 600 million people, essentially, you know, 600 million young people wanting a better future, many of whom have the prospect of a better future than their parents, and yet huge potential for things to go wrong, huge potential for unmet expectations, for the economy to falter, for war, for environmental disaster, you name it. You know, the list of problems that keep our government awake at night is minuscule next to the list of problems in India. You add to that the kinds of interstate tensions we've talked about, and I think while it's wonderful that in principle the Australian political class is saying let's embrace the Asian century, let's get the country ready to make money out of the middle classes of Asia or to engage at a social or diplomatic level, at the same time I do think that ordinary Australians probably aren't being prepared well enough for the possibility that the Asian century isn't going to be pretty. And it's going to be our problem too if China and Japan were to go to war, for example, even if we just have the kind of tensions we've seen this year as the new normal in Asia, sort of a constant round of brinksmanship and maritime provocation, coercion, whatever you call it. That's not good for business, it's not good for peace, it's not good for really shaping the regional future. So I think, I do think that although we can't predict how the future's going to go in Asia or the world, our government... really, our political class could do more to prepare Australia for this, and I worry that in this election year, that's not going to be on the agenda.
Yeah, I mean, India is a good example to me too, as a country that's so often left out, or a country that we should have really great relationships with, political, economic, cultural. It's all there, and yet we can't. There's a blockage there. We can't even get that one right. I think Hindi's taught now just at the ANU, perhaps at La Trobe University. There's a lot of talk. So even in a country like India where it doesn't pose the same challenges as perhaps China does, we don't seem to be able to nail it. And yet we have the time to compared to India.
Yeah, I actually think things have improved between Australia and India from a few years ago, where, I mean, in Melbourne, of all places, you know, you saw the challenges of, an aspiring class of Indian youth not having really the experience that they were expecting, and the Indian media making that a big foreign policy issue. I think things have actually got a bit better between Australia and India. But I think generally you're right. There seems to be a sense, in Canberra that we should write these wonderful documents that chart out how the country will engage with Asia. But then it sort of gets put out there into the debate, and there's not always a lot of follow-through at all levels of society.
Mm. So. I was struck by the Asia White Paper because it really tried to prepare the nation that we have to now go and we have to learn the languages, we have to do better at diplomacy, you name it, all the positives. But it didn't prepare Australians for the thought that China and the United States in the next 20 years might clash. Certainly China and Japan might clash. China actually might disintegrate. At least the Chinese economy might stop functioning the way it has for the last 30 years. It didn't prepare people for the downside, for the gloomy prospects of Asian development, which are certainly possibilities.
Well, I thought the biggest wake-up call with that was President Obama making a speech from our own parliament, Michael. Was that a sort of moment for Australia that we then washed over yet again?
I liked Obama's speech in the Australian Parliament.
Was it diplomatic for it to be given in our Parliament? Your old boss wasn't very happy.
No, that's true. My old boss didn't like that. But look, I thought Obama gave a good speech, and I was not offended by Obama. Saying, as the leader of an allied country of the United States, that human rights matters. I remember there was a time when the left believed in human rights, and so I wasn't offended by that. I mean, it goes back, I guess, to how you think Obama's policy on China has developed, and there probably Linda and I differ a little bit. But from my point of view, my reading is that Obama came into office trying to achieve a modus vivendi with the Chinese, whereby they could do a grand deal, and he could usher China up onto the winner's podium, and together they could solve some of these previously intractable problems like the Iranian nuclear question or North Korea or climate change or whatever. And I think certainly from Obama's point of view, the Chinese basically said, you know, talk to the hand. And you remember the Copenhagen climate change talks, for example, where China sent a sort of mid-ranking official to deal with Obama. And I think since then, Obama has toughened up. And it's partly, you know, to your point about the tension between optimism and realism, I think Obama has found that the world is a tougher place than he thought. And so he came into office talking about hope and change. He's ended up talking about reasonableness and balance and toughness. And he's found with China, as with other issues, that, you know, people don't care too much about his fine speeches and his Portuguese water dog and his BlackBerry and all the rest of it. Other capitals assess Obama on his toughness. And I think the speech has to be read in that context, that it was really only when Obama, in my view, toughened up with China that that relationships sort of got some stability. So I personally thought Obama's...
The story's not over yet, though, Michael.
That's true. That's also true.
I want to talk about Australian foreign policy sort of muddlement, I suppose. We had the defence paper from Rudd in 2009... we had the Asia White Paper last year, and then Julia Gillard released a new statement, the National Security Statement, which Michael helped launch. Mm. They're quite different, these three. The emphases are mm-hmm. different. Rudd was said to be too tough or too pessimistic, I think, about China. Perhaps the Asia White Paper was too much the other way. Where are we in our foreign policy, even with these broad statements that we all get to hear about?
Linda, do you want to talk about Australia-China relations? I know I'm going to disagree with you, but I just think that might...
Well, purely from the perspective of Australia-China, I'm not going to comment on the three documents. I think they are very different, and we're now waiting for a new defence white paper, which I'm sure will bring a new dimension to this whole discussion. But on Australia-China, just to go back to a point that Michael made, I actually thought it was a good speech by Obama. Where Michael and I differ is that I didn't think the appropriate place to hold it was in Australian Parliament, simply because China is also important for Australia. Australia needs to forge a very different kind of relationship, in my view, political relationship, with China, if China is going to continue to be such an important element in Australian prosperity. Something we don't like to say in a democracy is that the wise decisions, hopefully wise decisions, of a bunch of men, seven of them, who make their decisions in secret, are really going to have a great impact on the prosperity of our societies. We say that we're dependent on Chinese economic growth. We hope that China's economy will keep growing. But we never go as far as to say how dependent prosperity in our own societies is on this government, which we don't like because it's a one-party authoritarian state. So I think that's the only place where I differ. I think Obama needed to be tough on China, but I just question, was Australian Parliament the right place to do it because of this question of political trust? Australia hasn't a high-level dialogue, which would take place at a regular interval, for example, once a year with Chinese leaders. Problems are inevitable in every relationship, especially if it's one of your most important relationships. If leaders know each other, it helps quite a lot to be able to pick up the phone, to be able to meet, remember, oh, 6 months ago we had dinner. That's how human beings deal with each other. Australia doesn't have that kind of a relationship with China, and I think Australia should seek that kind of a relationship.
If I can just respond quickly, I think Linda's exactly right. We should be seeking that relationship with China. But as to whether Obama should have given that speech in the Australian Parliament, I mean, the fact is that the entire time I've been reading about foreign policy, one of the obsessions of the foreign policy class has been keeping America engaged in Asia. This has always been our great fear, that America would retreat, as it has done in the past. It would focus on Europe. It would have no interest in Asia. And then we would be left to fend for ourselves. And so for decades, really, we've been saying to the Americans, come on, be interested in Asia. Come to Australia, you know, invest in Asia. And finally, you have a president who does exactly that, who indeed talks about pivoting or reweighting the whole of US strategic policy towards Asia, who does us the great compliment of coming to Australia, then does us what you know, Sally, is an extraordinary compliment of giving an actually substantive speech rather than the usual bromides about the Battle of the Coral Sea and Aussie, you know, Sir John Monash and Aussies and Americans standing shoulder to shoulder, actually gives a tough-minded, substantive speech that is now remembered as the Canberra speech. And now we're all sort of fainting and blushing that, gosh, I wish he hadn't done that in our parliament. So, you know, I think we have to be robust enough to invite leaders and you know, if they say, think we don't agree with everything that they say, but I... Anyway, I wanted to say, Linda, I think it was fine.
Can I?
Please, Rory. Well, look, I was with Linda and now I'm not sure.
So. I'll come back to your question about the difference between the three papers, mainly because it's important to say where are we going from here. And in that, I'll pick up on the two, I think, two key points from Linda and Michael. Firstly, starting with Linda, those who've, I guess, worked within the Canberra, I guess, bureaucracy have seen over the years a lot of attempts to build engagement with China. And these may have been at too low levels. They may have been based on a limited understanding of how China works on the inside. And I completely agree with Linda's analysis that we need to really build that deep expertise. It doesn't help that our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade tends to value short-term managerial skills over deep country skills. Quite seriously, you'd be surprised, wouldn't you? But you know, the sure way not to get promoted in DFAT is to become an expert on a country. I can tell you
is
that.
Is that really? That's
well, it helps. It helps. Yeah. You've got to. Anyway, I better not go too far down that path.
No, go far.
It is being recorded, but Rory.
Attempts have been made to build the kind of engagement Linda's talking about, perhaps not at that leader's level. The really deeper question, though, is about this word trust. And I think Linda's analysis, which I strongly recommend to really, you know, challenge our thinking, nonetheless has this word trust in it, which I think can have multiple meanings when you're dealing with China. Because one question, I think, for our policymakers and certainly the security establishment that I guess I have some experience with is, how do you trust a country when it's hard to define the line between what the state's doing and what supposedly non-state entities are doing, where you, the government may not say this publicly, but it's quite well known that there's a lot of essentially cyber attacks against Australian entities emanating from entities within China. What does that tell you about trust? So I think there are some real questions to overcome there as to what trust means. Having said that, we should certainly make a better attempt than we have made. And finally, on Michael's point, I guess, about the alliance, I mean, I think those of us who wanted the US to engage more in Asia probably were a little bit shocked when it was so in your face. I mean, Obama speaking in the Australian Parliament, essentially telling China that, what was it again? I think, prosperity without freedom is another form of poverty, you know, which could have been seen as pretty
good
offensive.
Good lines spoken in the Australian Parliament.
Great lines.
We're in favour of that.
Sometimes the best lines don't have the best results. Anyway, I think it did, however, call us out on the question of what is the alliance for, what's the alliance about, because I think, again, the Canberra class, if you like, has always seen the alliance as something that we cultivate, we develop, but we don't want to go too far towards actually making a bold public commitment to the alliance. We'll do quiet things such as John Howard did, but putting essentially Australia on the line for the alliance, that's a new thing. And now that America's big strategic interests are in our backyard, are in the Asia-Pacific or the Indo-Pacific, questions about US forces being based in Australia, having access to Australia, these are going to remain at the fore of our debate. And even though I think on balance it's a good thing that we commit to the alliance, we do need a more sustained public debate about this, which finally goes to those white papers. It's fascinating that in 2009, Kevin Rudd's defence white paper said, essentially, China's a challenge. We have to increase Australia's strategic weight. We need a stronger navy and so forth. Of course, since then, the budget support for that has collapsed. Political support for that seems to have fallen away, and yet the strategic environment's gotten worse. So we're now in the position that we've got this white paper from 2009 that's speaking loudly, but we're still carrying a small stick, and the stick's getting smaller every day, which I think is the opposite of good diplomacy, according to the Teddy Roosevelt definition.
Well, what should we be doing, Michael?
What is to be done?
Well, one thing, I mean, one little thing, well, not little, but one thing that Australia should be doing is investing properly in diplomacy. You know the old phrase that talk is cheap, but it's good that talk is cheap. I mean, through diplomacy and through engagement, we can have influence in the world at a really good price. And yet the truth is Australian governments of both colours have deeply underinvested in diplomacy in the last couple of decades.
And is this about embassies and where you have them and the kind of people you've gotten them?
Is that the level you're talking about? Yeah, exactly. So, for example, in the late 1980s, Australia had about 1,000 diplomats posted overseas. And now, even though we're even more internationalised than we were then, and even though the world, the challenges the world presents have got more significant, we deploy a full one-third less than that. We have the smallest diplomatic network in the G20. We have one of the smallest diplomatic networks in the developed world, in the OECD. The OECD average for the number of embassies or the number of posts that you have around the world is 133. We have a puny 95. And so both under the former Liberal government, Liberal National government, and under the Labor government, we've underinvested in diplomacy, because in the post 9/11 period, we put enormous sums of money into the military and into the intelligence services, but the softer side of things, diplomacy, was left to the side. And now, of course, everyone has to share the burden, but DFAT didn't share the upside either. So, I mean, to give you just a couple of figures, if you look at our international investment, we spend about $25 billion a year on defence. We spend about $5 billion a year on foreign aid, and we spend $1 billion a year on diplomacy. And there is something wrong with those ratios. It's madness for a country of our size, in our neighbourhood, to be investing in those ratios. So this is probably the one thing I think that almost everybody at the Institute agrees on. We have different views on almost everything else, but I think a lot of us are really perturbed that governments are underinvesting in this. So one thing, if I could urge the audience, if you're interested in the world and if you think that Australia should play a prominent position, when you hear both parties talking about their foreign policies, ask how they're going to fund it.
Mm. What about the quality of the people we've got? I mean, I know Amanda Vanstone speaks Italian. Are the people that are running the embassies that we do have, the quality of the staff, they got the support, the resources, are they the people that we want, or is there a culture of political favours, you know, in appointments and that sort of thing? Are the very best people in each one of those embassies that we have? Perhaps, Rory, you can...
There's a couple of questions rolled into that. I mean, there's actually a surprisingly little political favouritism in Australian diplomacy. It's not that many posts that are led by political appointees. I think a bigger question goes to the efficiency of what we've got. I certainly agree with Michael that our diplomatic budget has been grossly sort of starved over the past 20 years, and it even goes down to issues like individual foreign ministers. I mean, I think Alexander Downer was quite proud of not asking for extra money for his department at a time when all other agencies were getting resources. But it also went to a sense that a public sense, I should add, a public perception that diplomats are, you know, comfortable people on the cocktail circuit in pinstripe suits, not doing much. The fact is that if you look at the the exponential growth in Australians travelling overseas in the last 20 or 30 years, the number of Australians who get into trouble overseas for all sorts of avoidable ways, the number who travel without travel insurance, this has become the daily problem of our diplomats. So people who can and should be essentially representing Australia's interests in a changing world are instead running around after people who've gotten into trouble for stealing a $10 bar mat in Thailand or something like that. There's a public expectation that's yes. completely out of whack with the resources the public's willing to allocate, and that means, because ultimately our consular budget and our diplomacy budget come out of the same small pot of money, that means we can't do modern diplomacy. The last point about efficiency is that we do have essentially 19th century bureaucratic structures in our foreign service, as indeed most foreign services around the world. Use of social media, the autonomy and initiative of individual officers, these are all still pretty much discouraged. And so until I think we see the system loosen up a bit, and indeed take in, for example, short-term lateral transfers from elsewhere, let our diplomats go and do something else for a while and then bring them back, rather than an old-fashioned 19th century British-style career service that's quarantined from the rest of society, we're not going to have a kind of diplomacy that's delivering for this changing world.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Linda, about, we can talk all night about any one tiny piece of what we've already begun mm-hmm. to talk about, but I think we never hear about things that never quite get to the list of things that can be addressed, the things that the three of you look at in your various areas of interest and you think, gee, I wish, wouldn't it be great if we could do this? And it never quite gets there because pressing crises or everyday pressing issues get in the way. Things we just don't quite get the time and the resources for. What would you do? You know, if you could have a concerted focus on something with the time and resources.
For Australian foreign policy. Mm. Well, I'm going to go back very briefly to that topic we already talked about. I would love for the Australian Prime Minister to fly to Beijing next week and meet with Xi Jinping and establish a personal relationship. I do think the personal relationships in this building trust, which I was talking about between countries' leaders is terribly important. She has been once to China since becoming Prime Minister.
But Kevin Rudd, Mandarin speaker, China file.
Doesn't always help, does it?
Doesn't always help, yeah.
As an outsider and having not lived in Australia when Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister, all I can say is that it doesn't always mean that if you speak Mandarin, it's going to work. But I do think that in the present situation, when relations actually between Australia and China are not bad, there's no crisis, there's no issue, there have been quite a few issues in past years before I moved to this country, I think really now is a great opportunity for Australia to make a bit of a mark. Australia isn't really noticed by China. Australia needs to be more noticed. The second thing I'd do is to make sure that Australian political leaders and whoever is in the next government pays a lot more attention to provincial leaders in China, provincial governors and provincial party secretaries. They are the people who in 2022 will take over the country. If you look at where the present seven leaders of China, the so-called Politburo Standing Committee, the all-powerful group of men who lead China, where they were 10 years ago, they were all, nearly without exception, provincial leaders in some of the most important or economically important provinces of China. Australian leaders need to go through that very long process of getting to know the next generation of leaders. That's what I would hope for as far as Australia-China is concerned.
Hmm. Michael.
I've got such a long list.
I know, it's hard to, you all do.
It's hard to think of them. Let me mention too quickly. One thing that I've always thought Australia should do is get out in front on trying to encourage our friends and neighbours in Asia to abolish the death penalty. Now, this is not a core, I would not say this is a core national interest of Australia's, but one thing that always strikes me is that whenever an Australian is on death row, suddenly the joint is up in arms and politicians and people are writing letters and all the rest of it. And the problem is it goes down very badly in those countries because they say, quite rightfully, the only time Australia bangs on about this is when you've got a convicted drug dealer who's on death row. And so I always felt, as somebody myself who believes that capital punishment is wrong, and given that both all the major parties say that they believe that capital punishment is wrong, it would be much more consistent and probably would protect our interests to actually go out there and actively try to encourage Asian countries that retain the death penalty, such as China and Vietnam and even Singapore, to abolish the death penalty. And then not only could we potentially move some of them up the spectrum, but we would protect ourselves from the accusation that we only care about Australians. And we could say, well, actually, that's not true, because we are trying to create a coalition, a regional coalition, if you like, and we could work with other abolitionist countries in the region we're trying to push the needle, move the needle a bit on the death penalty. Now, that's a bit idealistic, probably, for my two colleagues on the stage.
No, not for me, it isn't. I've been visiting the two Bali prisoners on death row, the Australian boys, for 6 years. So I'm very interested in this, and in fact there's a trend worldwide towards it, but not in America.
Towards abolishing it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just add to that we have a great paper by my colleague Dr. Dave McRae about death penalty politics in Indonesia, which very much looks at this question. Indonesia now, because they're themselves going out to try and protect their own citizens from being executed, are beginning to slowly rethink their own death penalty politics. So it's really a paper worth reading.
It's good to hear some idealistic ideas. Mm. I mean, that's partly
It's going to get harder, though, Michael. India's just started executing people.
That's true.
After 8 years, eight-year moratorium, and they've just started again. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's going to be a very tough job, I think. And I'm not going to add to the idealistic wish list by talking about nuclear abolition, which I think is a very worthwhile objective, and with a number of colleagues, I've done research in that space. But it's again, it's beyond the horizon, beyond the death penalty horizon. Even I think I'd probably take it a step back to something to two things that I'd like to see really Australia do in terms of really preparation or self education for whatever the Asian century looks like, whether it's good or bad or indifferent. I think, and it won't be indifferent, it'll be good or bad. The Asian Century White Paper that the government put out last year had some great aspirations about, for example, suggesting quotas for, I think, 20% of corporate boards having essentially Asia skills or Asia literacy. But it struck me that there was no such quota imposed for our politicians. I think that, quite seriously, if you look at the foreign engagement of Australian parliamentarians, I'm pretty sure that research travel to Europe is still pretty popular. I'm sure that fraternal relations of the Australian Labor Party with various Labor parties in Europe are still pretty
good. Didn't a senator go to Malaysia on the weekend?
There we go. You know, whatever you say about Xenophon, you know, he certainly
he tried
went to Asia. Quite seriously, I think there needs to be a much more concerted effort to interest the Australian political class in Asia so that it's not just bureaucrats talking to bureaucrats or business people talking to business people. So I'd love to see research trips to India in summer, or perhaps research trips in the Indian summer, research trips, you know, to the north, to the demilitarised zone in North Korea. I mean, that kind of thing.
In winter.
In terms of self-education, in winter, that's right. And then, looking at a more bureaucratic level, it strikes me that we're always, our leaders are always talking about trying to resolve or manage the conflicts in Asia, the South China Sea, the East China Sea. But the fact is, if ever we actually get leaders in Asian countries saying, OK, we go to talk, we've had a crisis, we've had a Cuban Missile Crisis moment, we have to work out how to manage this. There's been very little research, very little preparation for actually how do the militaries of Asia communicate peacefully with one another in a stable way. During the Cold War, the Russians, the Soviets and the Americans actually had a much better system for managing crises than any two countries in Asia have now, which is quite astounding. Mm. there's a lot of work that, for example, parts of the Australian military or diplomatic service could do to prepare the kind of, I guess, infrastructure of communications and protocols and rules and so forth for actually managing conflict or preventing conflict in Asia. And that's, I guess, if I had a few million dollars to spare in the DFAT budget, that's where I'd be sending it.
I want to ask you quickly, I suspect this is a quick one, about whether or not an Abbott or a Gillard or a Rudd or a Turnbull or a God knows what change of government would make any difference in the substance of our foreign policy.
I think it does. I mean, it depends on whether you think that leaders matter and whether you think that individuals and individual agency matters. I mean, a lot of people say they don't. And a lot of people say, well, you know, countries just have national interest and they're just like a computer and they'll just sort of act according to their national interest. But I must say, having worked for a Prime Minister myself, I don't think that's how it works. I think the personal preferences of leaders, where they want to take it, what they're interested in, I think those things do matter critically. So we don't know what kind of foreign policy Prime Minister Mr. Abbott would be. We know that back in the day he was very attracted to the idea of the Anglosphere, for example, whereby countries like Australia have special relations, I guess, with countries of similar English-speaking language countries with similar values and culture. Having said that, there's another theme to his what he says about foreign policy. I mean, he's been very critical of the government for its, you know, for being too focused on Geneva and not focused enough on Jakarta, as he said. So I guess he's foreshadowing a regional focus there. So I don't think we know how it would change, but I think it would change. And I think he would set out a couple of priorities that he would want to move on, and I think he would be able to move the needle on that.
Linda, do you think in China they really care who's in charge here?
Oh, I agree with Michael. I think, A, leaders matter and leadership matters. I mean, both. I think, as I was saying, the personal touch does matter. I certainly hope whoever becomes the next Prime Minister of Australia will very soon visit Beijing. I think it should happen once a year if China is important to Australia. So I don't know what kind of a China policy Abbott would have if he became Prime Minister. But I'm sure it would be different just simply because he has different, like Michael said, priorities.
Mm. Yeah, I think I agree that leaders matter, although it's striking that the five or six key relationships that the recent Asian Century White Paper emphasised, China, India, Japan, Indonesia, South Korea and the United States, I think are essentially, if you go to the last year of the Howard government, they were the major relationships that were being built up at that time. Mm. So there is a continuity. Mm. It's perhaps how you prosecute those relationships and how effectively you do it where a leader makes a difference, and a leader genuinely being interested in foreign policy makes a difference. I think that I would be amazed if...
Officials always say that officials make foreign policy.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. Leaders just get in the way, that's right, that's right. No, but I would be astounded if Abbott didn't seek to reinvent himself and to embrace Asia as a leader. I think he's got quite a long way to go. It would be nice to hear less about the Anglosphere, although I note from Battle Lines that India's part of the Anglosphere in that book. So there's the beginning of a pivot to Asia. But look, again, it'll be that question about whether our leaders get so distracted by short-term political challenges or short-term political trouble in this country that they refuse to see that bigger picture that they talk about. That's what would depress me, regardless of who's in.
I mean, Julia Gillard famously said that she wasn't interested in foreign policy and foreign tours, although she's been quite good when things seem to have gone much better for her, in fact, abroad than at home.
It's also, you know, that's also a very consistent historical pattern in the sense that prime ministers usually don't have a deep background in foreign policy when they come to office. Yeah. I mean, Rudd was the outlier in being a China foreign policy wonk and, in fact, a former diplomat. You know, Hawke had a lot of ties through the international trade union movement, but he didn't have a deep background in it. The same went for Keating. I mean, Howard, people forget this, but Howard had a very difficult start in foreign policy. He had a lot of troubles in the relationship with China, and, you know, I distinctly remember he went over to visit President Clinton, for example, and there was a big scandal because there was no press conference and he was kept waiting at the White House gates and so on for a long time. So I think prime ministers, it's a big step up to become suddenly a foreign policy principal. And most politicians have spent their whole career selling politics to an Australian audience, and suddenly they need to step up and they need to find points of connection with leaders who are very sophisticated and very experienced, and it takes a bit of time. But as you say, Gillard, I mean, one advantage that that Prime Minister Gillard has is she's good with people, and she's been able to form nice personal connections with characters like President Obama. I think one advantage, just to finish this point, even though the opposition was not highly enthusiastic, if I can put it that way, about the UN Security Council bid, whomever is elected Prime Minister in September, if indeed that's when the election takes place, this will be a massive advantage for them. Because, for example, if Mr. Abbott is elected Prime Minister, on his first visit to Washington, he doesn't just go to the Oval Office and talk about the alliance. He can say, right, well, what's on the Security Council docket? What are we going to do about Syria? This is what we think about North Korea. So having these baubles like the Security Council membership is not just about prestige. It's about influence, and it's about getting you into the conversations that we want to be in.
I just want to pick up on that. I time and again, especially at the Institute, hear how depressing it is that Australian political leaders don't engage enough on foreign policy issues. This is universal. In Finland, in the United States, in China today, newly elected leaders or newly appointed leaders are mostly focused on the economy, and all sorts of domestic issues. That's what they really want to focus on. So I think Australia is just grappling with a problem which is quite inherent in the way at least most of the world runs. I'm struck, though, having just said that, that there hasn't really been a proper public debate, and this is picking up on something Rory said earlier, about what kind of an alliance Australia wants with the United States. I mean, people like Michael's old boss, Mr. Keating, many other prominent former leaders, even retired military officers, have come out questioning not the alliance. No one, I've at least heard, wants to get rid of the alliance, but what kind of an alliance? How should that alliance be shaped? There's sort of a hush-hush about that, at least from my point of view as a non-Australian, that why don't Australians debate the alliance openly? I know it's a sensitive question, but it needs to be debated.
Yeah, it seems there are ideas about our security, about, you know, where we are. There are a lot of old ideas about Australian security that have suddenly or seemingly suddenly changed, and the new ideas around it, whether some might be good, some maybe not so good, but there doesn't seem to me at the moment to be a coherent strategy for our security. Would you agree, Rory?
Well, look, the authors of the National Security Strategy that the Prime Minister released in January would beg to differ, but I think you're right. And I think the challenge is, again, it's identifying the risks, it's identifying what we're going to do about it, and it's earmarking the resources. And I think there is a broad sense of the risks, although they're not fully communicated in documents like the Asian Century White Paper.
And not talked about openly.
And there's a huge reluctance, there's a huge reluctance now to really allocate serious resources to defence. I take Michael's point that our defence budget is a lot bigger than our aid or DFAT budget, and I think the diplomatic budget should be increased. But our defence budget is now at the lowest proportion of GDP since the 1930s, and I don't mean that in some ominous way, it's just a fact.
Yeah.
Again, this has happened, I think, without public debate, and I don't think the public's quite aware that we're now the odd one out in our region. That doesn't mean we have aggressive intent, but it does mean that if we want somehow to reshape the alliance, if we want to be more like France, as some people say, be an ally who can stand up to your ally, well, one reason France is that France has nuclear weapons. Now, I'm not at all advocating that Australia should have nuclear weapons, but you do need to think about how we're going to be able to stand on our own two feet a bit more if we want to moderate the alliance.
And look after New Zealand.
Well, and look after the South Pacific. I mean, Australia has this, you know, this huge claim of territory that it seems responsible for or is expected to be responsible for with a population of 23 million people. At some point, we either have to match our resources to our responsibilities or maybe start abrogating some of our responsibilities, and I agree that's a matter for a political debate.
Mm. Is some of this a sort of political hangover from Keating's attempts at getting public conversation?
No, it's all Keating's fault.
I mean, I just wonder if it's still a sort of hangover from that, that politicians won't allow a big public conversation about these things. Or they just want to talk about, as you said, you know, economy, economy, economy.
Look, I think I agree with Linda that, of course, it's always domestic issues in every democracy that, or in almost every democracy, that decide elections. But having said that, I think there is something very parochial about Australian politics at the moment. You know, we were having a conversation about this last week, and I was saying, well, even in the United States, of course, all the elections there are decided predominantly on domestic issues, and yet, you know, every 4 years, one of the three presidential debates will always be on foreign policy. Mm. And it's all... Now, of course, they play a different role in the world and they have a much larger defence budget and so on. But I don't think it's unreasonable to hope or to expect or to demand that that a country like ours that is heavily dependent on trade, that is a long way physically from our sources of prosperity and security, should have an intelligent debate on the world and how we relate to the world alongside and probably slightly behind the debate we have about how we distribute resources within the country. Mm.
If you would like to ask a question, please put your hand up and somebody will put a microphone in it. And
good evening. My name is Ordan Andrevsky. I'm with the United Macedonian Diaspora. And I have a question for Mr. Michael Fullove. Last October, the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee presented the Foreign Minister with a detailed report on the inquiry into Australia's overseas representation, and I would like to hear your views on what will the Foreign Minister do with the report, given the, I guess, the fact that he's basically held hostage by the Treasurer and the Department of Finance when it comes to money.
Well, I think you're talking about a report that I'm not sure if it was the subcommittee or the joint committee or whatever, which basically, if I can take a little bit of, if I can have some bragging rights, I think drew on a lot of Lowy Institute work that was done by a colleague of mine, Alex Oliver, and others, basically along the themes that some of us have been talking about, that that we are starving our Foreign Service of resources, even though I take Rory's point. It's not to say there aren't efficiencies to be gained. It's not to say there aren't better ways that DFAT can spend the money that it does have. But having said that, having smart, professional people deployed overseas in significant enough numbers that they can do the smart work that our national interests demand as well as look after Aussies in trouble is really important. Now, in terms of what they'll do, like all these things, it comes down to political will. And I think the more that all of us put hard questions on our leaders, the more likely they are to react to it. And at the moment, as Rory said, I mean, you can sort of, you know, probably if I say the word diplomat to most Australians, a lot of them probably would think, well, you know, cocktail parties and flying business class and stripy pants and all the rest of it. But that's not really what modern diplomacy is about. It's about identifying our interests and progressing our interests and progressing our values. And so when the Prime Minister launched the Asian Century White Paper, I asked her that question. You know, it's terrific that we're setting these goals about succeeding in the Asian Century, but can I ask you about the resources that your government is prepared to spend on our diplomacy? And I think it's incumbent upon anyone who thinks that's important to ask those questions.
Thank you, Peter O'Donoghue. I have a question which is just slightly off the the subject of our immediate region, and if this is a distraction, feel free not to respond. But I just wanted to ask whether the panel has a view about the recent events in Israel and the death of the Australian citizen. In The Age in the last few days, there's been quite extensive coverage of the death and some of the related matters, all of which seem to be quite mysterious and novel to me, but disturbing. And I'm just wondering if you have a view about how that reflects on Australian diplomacy or the absence of it.
I can offer something.
Rory, do you want to go first and then Linda?
No.
Rory.
Look, I mean, I think the facts are still coming out, at least in the public domain, and you know, I know no more about it than you, but I think that some of the questions it's certainly raised in my mind are, firstly, I mean, apart from the obvious human tragedy of it, obviously at a personal level and at a family level, at a diplomatic or political level, it raises some really tricky questions about dual nationality or dual citizenship. Now, Michael's done a lot of research on diasporas, for example, and there are lots of, you know, plus sides to people having dual nationality or migration or links to, or loyalties, in fact, to more than one country. But you come to a situation like this and it raises really difficult questions because, of course, some of the allegations, or at least some of the reports in the media suggest that he may have been communicating certain information to the Australian intelligence services, and this would have got him in trouble in Israel. But, of course, this man was an Australian citizen. So I think it raises some really difficult questions, and certainly one of the mysteries still, at least in the public mind, is who knew what in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and in government at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's an intriguing and very sad story, and it's one I'm reluctant to say too much about because every day it seems there's new speculation about what might have happened and what is at the heart of it. I suppose, again, we don't know who knew what within DFAT, but you can say from a consular point of view, notwithstanding what I've just been saying about Australians making a lot of, and what Rory was saying about Australians making a lot of demand on the Australian government for consular protection. Nevertheless, this is an incident where this individual, who was an Australian citizen as well as an Israeli citizen, was in a very difficult spot indeed. And one hopes that when the full story comes out, one hopes that the Australian government was providing whatever the level of appropriate consular protection or keeping track of the case in some sort of way, because I think that is one thing that Australians can expect. Not that they will be able to get off charges or that they'll be able to get away with avoiding the consequences of their actions when they're in other countries, because of course one of the core elements of international law is that when you're in another country you are subject to that country's laws. And even more so, of course, when you're a citizen of that country, as this gentleman was. But having said that, on the other hand, he was also an Australian citizen. So I hope that when the full story emerges, or at least more of the very partial story that has emerged so far, when more of it emerges, I hope that the Australian government did what was appropriate to look after his interests.
How do our intelligence services rate?
Are you cleared to know
well,
that?
Well, Rory... Rory's the one sort of.
I know.
Of
I'm looking at him. Yeah.
Yeah. No, look, that's a very general question, and I can give you a very general answer.
I mean, we knew the Mossad were good in the 1970s, and you know, certain countries have had certain reputations. What is our reputation for? Given we're punching above our weight, we're all at the big table. Yeah. How good are we?
Look, I mean, globally, I think one can speculate that it's not bad. That is especially, and this is partly due to some of the reforms after the Iraq WMD questions back in 2000, or intelligence failure, I should say, back in 2003, 2004, and after the Bali bombings. There have been some reasonable reforms of the Australian intelligence services, Australian intelligence community. I think we have, for example, a clear firewall between so-called collection and so-called analysis. In a lot of countries, that's not the case. So, in other words, the people collecting the information are analysing the information and perhaps being influenced politically in the way they analyse that information. I think we are pretty close to best practice on that, and we've certainly improved. There obviously were a few issues in the past. But as to the sort of the more cloak and dagger stuff that you're alluding to, I couldn't possibly comment.
Hi. My question is related to US influence on Australian politicians. I've been furiously trying to Google the details, but I haven't come up with... there's some details in my question that I need you to jump in and tell me if I'm right or wrong. I'm thinking of an ALP senator, faceless man. He's no longer a senator, and like a good Labor man, he's working for James Packer. Can't remember his name.
Oh, Senator Mark Harbib.
Mark Harbib,
yeah.
I seem to recall, this is another detail I need you to check on, but I seem to recall
don't
that...
Don't they have Wi-Fi at the Wheeler Centre, Sally?
No.
It's my 3Gs playing up. I seem to recall that Arbib was mentioned in the WikiLeaks cables as meeting with the Americans and giving them quite high-level briefings on what was going on internally in the Labor Party, and even possibly the fact that there was going to be a move on Rudd.
Some of that. What's your question?
The question is, how often does this sort of thing happen? I remember Bob Brown said at the time that it wasn't that unusual that he was meeting with the Americans. The question is, how in awe of American power are Australian politicians, and therefore how easy is it for the Americans to manipulate our politicians?
Well, I'll have the first go at it. I mean, look, foreign diplomats meet with politicians and think tankers and everybody else all the time. And they're constantly asking to come and speak with us and get our ideas on things. And then they scurry back to their embassies and they write these up as cables and they send them back to their capitals. And this is one of the jobs that embassies do. I don't remember the details in that leaked cable, but from memory, it was sort of the usual political rumour and scuttlebutt that you would expect diplomats to ask serving politicians about. And they reported it back, perhaps more breathlessly than it deserved, even though probably what he was saying to them was available in that day's Age or that day's Herald. So I think you need to be careful. Just because something was leaked by Mr. Assange, or just because it appears, you know, top secret cable, doesn't mean that it's, as some of the tabloid reporting of that story indicated, that he was an agent of influence or he was somehow disloyal or something like that. This is the usual scuttlebutt that happens every day of the week in Parliament House. So in terms of being how in awe of American power are Australian politicians, you know, I think in my experience a lot of Australian politicians are interested in the United States. Partly probably it's because of their power and their wealth. Partly it's because it's a great story, and it's a country that produces incredible stories and incredible characters, like Franklin Roosevelt and his five remarkable envoys. So people are interested in that. But, you know, equally, there is a China lobby in Parliament House. There are politicians who are focused on China. There are politicians who are very focused on Japan and Taiwan and so on. So I think it was a typical example of a tabloid beat-up.
I would just like to really re-emphasize what Michael just said. Coming from a European country where all the time elections are happening and parties are losing power and another is coming on, that's normal for politicians and diplomats to discuss what's going to happen in the political life of a country. It doesn't yet mean anything. The whole role of diplomats is to understand the country that they're working in and to report back so that the government that they're working for can prepare for changes. It's perfectly normal. On the question of how in awe. I certainly don't know. I don't know enough Australian politicians. But I will say that I've met a lot of Australian politicians who know all sorts of gossip about Chinese politicians and are becoming, which is a good sign, increasingly interested in does Xi Jinping really watch Hollywood movies? Is he really a fan of the Second World War, certain types of Hollywood movies, et cetera, et cetera? This is all, I think, quite healthy. I hope...
Does he watch Hollywood movies?
He does indeed.
He does. Okay.
Westerns, as according to my sources.
You heard it first.
Accurate gossip. Yeah.
The day that a show, which I admit I haven't watched, is, I think it's called American Planet or American something.
Planet America.
Planet America. When there's a Planet China, which is as popular in Australia, then I'll think that Australia is engaging with China.
Mm. Well, we'll have made the China choice then, won't we? I mean, at this point about influence, I just want to, as I think the only, confessing to being the only former diplomat on the stand here, certainly if diplomats don't collect that sort of, I guess, information, which is literally having the sort of conversations that journalists have and so forth, they're not doing their job. If Australian diplomats in other countries aren't talking to politicians or people who think they know something about the future of that country, your taxpayers' money is being wasted. And I hope that Kiwi politicians are as in awe of our diplomats as Australian politicians are of Americans.
I love the idea of a sudden flurry of people writing to their MPs demanding more information about embassies here and there and where our diplomacy money is being spent.
Can the Wheeler Centre organise that?
Oh, we can have a go. Yeah. Look, sadly, our hour is up. It's gone so fast. There was so much more we could have talked about. I wish you guys were in Melbourne. It would make a lot more sense to me. But as it is, the Lowy Institute, a really world-class institute, is in Sydney. It has a very accessible website, and everything these guys publish is available there. And you can really roam around on it for hours and hours. Michael's book is Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America to War. It's out in May. Penguin are publishing it. I know it's going to be great. I really want to thank the three of you for coming to Melbourne, especially to talk to us tonight. I've found it really, really fascinating and fun as well. Please thank Dr. Michael Fullilove, Linda Jacobson and Rory Metcalf. And just very quickly, thank you too. If it's your first Fifth Estate tonight, just to let you know, it's on every fortnight on a Tuesday evening at 6:15, and we take an issue of the day or an undercooked issue and we get the best and brainiest people to come and talk about it. So please come often and have a good night.
Subscribe to the Fifth Estate podcast for your fortnightly taste of provocative and considered news analysis. And for a full program of talks, visit wheelercentre.com.